Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Q&A with Lama K, Handling Anger, Developing a Heart of Love by Lama Kathy Wesley. In another installment of her occasional series, Lama Kathy answers a variety of questions from the Sangha, touching on developing the wish to benefit beings, working with difficult emotions, and applying Dharma in daily life. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for coming today. I'm a little bit uncertain where to start. I was supposed to give the Dharma talk next week, and now I'm giving it today, but that is because I wrote the wrong name on my calendar. So even lamas make mistakes. In fact, we probably make more than the normal person makes. Thank you so much. Super kind of you. Thank you. Thank you. And so we're going to have a very interesting Dharma talk today because you're going to help write it. I do this from time to time when I visit other Dharma centers where I ask people for things they want to hear about, things they're curious about, things that maybe they've read Buddhist books, and those Buddhist books, they have questions in their mind because of something they've read. And so so I'm going to do that today. And I'm sure that all of you have questions in your mind about meditation. You have questions in your mind about how meditation and life work or don't work, and how our minds both work and don't work. So I think we're going to have some fun talking about all of these things. So thanks for being here today. We start with a prayer, and the prayer is the prayer of taking refuge in the Buddha as one's teacher, the Dharma as one's path, and the Sangha as one's community. And we'll recite the refuge in English two times, and then we will recite it once in Tibetan. The reason for this is that we really need to understand the meaning of these words. You know, even though they're given to us by our Tibetan teachers in Tibetan, we really need to connect with their meaning. So we'll recite them two times for the meaning and once for the blessing. So here we go. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sanje Chudan Soji Chonamla Jang Chu Pardu Tani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Besunam Ki Drola Penshir Sanjay Drupasho. Okay, thanks everyone. I'll say a short prayer of my own, then we'll begin. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi War Pede Ten Shula Kadrin Jambo Gone Che Sun Te Kusum Tugging a Drip Sal to Soul. Okay, thanks very much. Okay, so I'm curious if there's anything in particular you'd like to hear today. I also have a magic answering eight ball book in case I need it for topics. But anybody have questions, curiosities, things you'd like to know? You got one? All right. You're speedy.
I'll get the ball rolling, maybe.
Okay, thanks a lot,
Michael.
Warm
everybody up.
Thanks.
So I'm a gardener, and it's very difficult to be a gardener and do no harm and don't kill.
Yeah.
Because slugs want my lettuce more
than
I do. And just this morning, I was cutting down some ornamental grass, and as I got down to a certain layer, there was a bird's nest with an egg in it, and I didn't crack the egg, but I imagine the mama is not going to be too happy with me. And so it's a difficult negotiation when you take the precepts seriously and you want to abide by them, but you also don't want slugs to eat all of your vegetables.
I totally get this. I thank you very much for this question, and I think from my point of view, that human beings and nature, we've been interacting and trying to get the better of one another, you know, from time immemorial, right? And I remember hearing my teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, talk about this very thing, because it's been a problem forever. And I think that that what he said is that there is no method of eating on this planet that doesn't cause some kind of death. And he said, you know, whether you are eating meat or not eating meat, eating plants or whatever, you know, there is some kind of death associated with food. And he said, and so the Buddha's teaching is that you have to try to keep down the numbers. You just have to try to keep down the numbers, because it's really, in fact, the Buddha forbade his monastics from going out walking during the rainy season, because the likelihood of them killing worms and slugs and insects in the road was, you know, massively more. And so they started the tradition of the rainy season retreat. So what I tell folks is that please always be grateful to every creature that died so you could live. And make the aspiration that when you eat the food you eat and so forth and so on, and enjoy the flowers and all of these things, that you dedicate some of that goodness to the beings who died so you could live. We have to also just be conscious of all of this without it weighing us down too much. And one of the things that one of my friends does, she's a gardener, is when she's weeding, she recites mantras audibly. And she makes sure that she prays over, you know, over her critters that she finds that she has accidentally killed while roughing up the earth or spraying the plants and things like this. And we can just basically take responsibility and make the aspiration that in our future life, we don't have to have this kind of relationship. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. Now that we know that plants make sounds, what? The Dalai Lama was asked, are plants sentient? And should we stop eating them because are they sentient? And he said, well, we can't speak to them. So there's no way for us to know whether they're sentient or not. But now we're finding out they make sounds. So I don't know. Can communication be far behind, right? So we have to just have respect, as much respect as we can have for ourselves and for the animals, too. I hope that's helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Anything anybody else? Yes, yeah. Okay, good. Oh, we got it. We got a cadence going here. Thanks.
Thank you for taking my question, too.
Yeah.
So my question is about, you know, a little bit more specifically, you know, post-pandemic, I mean, I think...
Yeah.
You know, the pandemic really kind of separated us from each other, you know, in terms of community and social distancing and all kinds of ways.
Right, right, right.
And so I'm thinking about relationships and understanding that, you know, the basis of all suffering kind of is attachment, right? Mm-hmm. So like post-pandemic, trying to reach out to people again and trying to form relationships, you know, like how do I balance out this idea of, you know, not wanting to form unhealthy attachments or like, I mean, I want to form attachments again, you know, because it's part of being a human being, but I'm not quite sure exactly how to, you know, avoid all that suffering that I'm going to be experiencing by attaching to people again. And, you know, is it worth it? You know, I mean, I think it is, right?
In fact, I've been thinking about this. I appreciate this question. I've been thinking about this lately. Have you guys been thinking about this? It's like how weird it is that we're all trying to figure out how to do relationships again. I don't know, because it's like, it's weird, isn't it? It's just weird. And I was talking to someone before coming in here today, and I said, you know, human beings do extremes really well. All or nothing. This or that. Yes and no. We do extremes really well, but it's middle we don't do very well. And relationships are all about the middle, aren't they? You know, where I can't have my way all the time. You can't have your way all the time. I don't want to be rejected by you, but I don't want you to reject me either. You know what I'm saying? So it's like we don't do middle very well. And so I think coming from like a genuine place is got to be the default mode, because this also helps with the other thing you're talking about. Because somebody asked my teacher about this once. They said, you know, in Buddhism, we're not supposed to have attachments, and yet we have family. We have kids. We have parents. We have kids. We have siblings. We got people who are we're responsible for. And what about those relationships? And he said, when you talk about non-attachment, he said, it's not that you need to love your people less. Okay. He said, you need to love everybody else more. Which I think is really interesting, because that's what we tend to do. We tend to have our people and everybody else, right? And so we're very attached to our people, but we have no caring for the people outside our fence, whatever fence we build, right? And so I feel like we have to be willing to reach out across the fence to help to connect with people who may be feeling the same discomfort we are feeling. And we have to find a place to meet those people, because they're probably feeling just as uncomfortable and just as weird as we feel. Because it's like, when I was in 3-year retreat, we spent, I'm going to say 6 months in total silence, because it was required. 6 months of total silence. All we did was write notes to each other. 6 months, and like the day that total silence ended was really weird, because we hadn't spoken to each other for 6 whole months, but we had been in the same dining room, we'd been in the same kitchen, we'd been in the same shrine room, we actually chant out loud, and yet we don't know how to relate to each other because we just hadn't been relating for 6 months. And I feel that that's very similar to what's going on right now. You don't want to make a mistake, but then you really crave connection with people. You want to be connected with people. You want to link up and be part of people, because we're social beings. We need that. So I think what we're looking for is the right amount of attachment. Oh, no, the middle. Humans don't do middle. We do all or nothing, but middle is hard. So we have to not love our people less, but love everybody else more, and try to build our relationships around, we have to try to build our relationships around knowing that that person feels just like we do. They're uncomfortable and so forth and so on, and we may need to negotiate a little bit about this middle before we can find ways to relate. What I try to do is I try to recognize that I try to come into conversations with the other person's benefit in mind. Like, even if I, when I walk up to the microphone and ask questions at the big monastery when my teacher was sitting in the teaching seat, it would scare the heck out of me. I would always be afraid that I would make some kind of verbal or cultural mistake. But after a while, I just decided that I was going to go up to that microphone and say to myself, before I opened my mouth, I'd say to myself, look, even if I make an utter fool of myself up here, may that be a benefit to somebody. And that is kind of, that's for me, kind of my middle. That's kind of where my middle is that I try to be present with people when I can be and understand that they feel stuff too. But I'm not sure that answered your question, but it was fun to talk about it.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'd like to narrow in on it, but you know, I don't want to hog the mic. So, but I appreciate the answer, and it's you know, it's a huge concern of mine, right? You know, these days,
right.
You know, relationships and attachment. It's you know, right. And I'm sure it's for a lot of people too. So, thank you.
Yeah, our connection needs to be based on caring. I think that's really what it comes down to. And sometimes caring about people, even though you don't know them, just wishing for their benefit, simply wishing sincerely for their benefit. That sincerity communicates. You know, and that's, and ways, but the other part, there's bad stuff about attachment, which is attachment is bad when our connection with somebody means we try to control them. Oopsie. I'm guilty. I don't know about you guys, but every now and then I find myself trying to control other people and how they feel and what they think. And I'm like, what? You know, where'd all that meditation training go, right? But I think that that's something we have to recognize and begin to watch for is the unhealthy side of attachment. And then try to always be present and recognize that and back up from it when you can. One time I was having an argument with my husband, and I actually like did this, the timeout sign. And I said, I'm being stupid. This is dumb. I still think I'm right, but let's do this. Let's do it your way. You know, it's like this is dumb. This is just, and anyway, so thank you for that. Yeah. Hey, hi there.
Howdy.
Hey.
So I have maybe two questions.
Sure.
The first one is, and it's sort of what you were talking about earlier. It has to do with the retreat you did and the 6 months of silence.
Oh, yeah.
So is that silence just a lack of communication verbally and like in general, or because you said that you could, you know, write stuff down. Could you also sign, use sign language, something like that, or would that be not allowed?
I get it. I think maybe I need to tell folks what the purpose of the silence was. That would probably fill in the blanks for you. Okay. I don't know if anybody here is familiar with mantra meditation, you know, where you recite a mantra. It's part of the Tibetan tradition, but it's also part of the Hindu tradition. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a practice called mantra, and you usually, when you're meditating on mantra, you will close your eyes and visualize a Buddha or Bodhisattva either in front of you, or if you've received the blessing of that empowerment, you visualize yourself as a Buddha or Bodhisattva, made of light and so forth. You visualize your body as being made of light and looking like the Buddha or Bodhisattva of your practice, and you recite the mantra of that Buddha or Bodhisattva, and then you try to keep your mind on the meditation. You try to keep your mind on the meditation, so your body, speech, and mind is all involved. And so the function of silence was that we were doing a meditation like that. Everybody was doing the same one. And so it was basically a withdrawal into the meditation, into you know, the visualization and mantra. It was like pulling back into that. And so technically we weren't even supposed to make eye contact with each other, but we did it all the time because we were goofy and we didn't really understand the purpose of it. But think about how it would be if you treated everybody else like they were Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, with kindness and with goodness. We couldn't manage that because we're flawed human beings. You know, in my retreat, we weren't able to accomplish that. But even now that I understand the idea, it meant a lot more to me once I understood the idea. And so it wasn't that someone was trying to be unkind to us or to restrain us and put us in jail or something. It wasn't like that. It wasn't a punishment. It was basically supposed to be an absorption into the meditation, but because we were essentially like spiritual children, we didn't really get it and didn't participate in the way we could have. Does that explain for you?
Yeah, so what I'm kind of getting from that is it's you're trying to put your all of your energy into the meditation itself and not into external communication.
Correct.
Unless it's absolutely necessary.
Correct. That's really correct. And you know what I learned from that period? I'm just now remembering. It's just kind of coming back to me now. It's like I didn't have to impress somebody. I didn't have to put on a show for somebody. I didn't have to entertain anyone. And there was a certain relief in that, because it's a heavy thing, right? You know, because you feel that you always have to be on, and you have to worry about what people think of you, and like what it meant. For 6 months, I was supposed to not be thinking about that stuff, but I did think about that stuff, but not as much. And that was what I noticed that was, to me, the most liberating part of it was like, oh, like I don't have to like put on for somebody. I can just be here. I can just be present with somebody without trying to get them to do something for me. You know what I mean? It's like there was no transactional stuff. It was interesting.
That sounds a lot to me like masking, like being able to stop masking for a time.
Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. I get you.
But the other question I had.
Sure.
So I took refuge about a few weeks ago. And yesterday we had that
workshop.
I was curious if you could just let everyone know sort of like what the roadmap is for the Buddhist practice. Like you take refuge, you do precepts, things like that.
I really appreciate that question. That's cool. Yeah. I make a joke about why people enjoy Tibetan Buddhism, especially people who maybe don't have a good connection with what we would call organized religion. And I say, who said we're organized? We are anything but organized. That's why so many people are interested and curious about Tibetan Buddhism, because it looks like there's like, what do you guys do anyway? And from time to time, I tell people, that's not a bug, that's a feature, okay? It's not a bug, it's a feature. There actually is a path, right? And it goes from A to B to C to D and so forth. But where you go in is going to depend on your own interest, to be honest, right? Because, you know, everybody says in some organizations, you have to start at class A, do class B, do class C. And we do have that. We have the introduction to meditation course and the introduction to Buddhism course. We have that. So that's A, B, C, D. So we've got that. But you can join a class anywhere, which I feel is like genius in a way, because it like lets people just like the luck of the draw determines where you are. And then all you have to do is come in and just keep coming back, and then you'll get all the courses. And but there is actually a path. Some people like the chanting and the meditation of chanting. They like to do chant meditation, and so they'll come to our chant meditations. Again, not knowing A, B, C, D, where they are, but they know they like the chanting, and the chanting, it helps them. That was me. I went to the chanting, and I'm like, I have no idea what this is, but I like it. And so slowly then you get the path revealed to you by the organization or by people in the organization. So when a person is ready to begin like serious daily Dharma practice, they can talk with any one of the meditation instructors who teach the course, or they can talk to any of the lamas and talk to us about how the path works. The path begins with daily practice, if you can take on a daily practice. But some folks don't start there. They start with taking refuge. They start with hearing about the ceremony in which you take the Buddha as your teacher, the Dharma as your path, and the Sangha as your community, and where you go before an image of the Buddha and say, I take refuge in the Buddha as my teacher, and so on. And then after that, then people will have the path explained to them, that it starts with taking refuge and establishing a daily practice. And then it deepens as you study the basic basics of Buddhism, as taught in some of our basic books, like Excellent at the Beginning by Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, or his book Dharma Paths and Excellent at the Beginning teach a lot of basics in Dharma. But then you'll actually work with one of the lamas, because what we do is we help people figure out what part of the Dharma is best with them, what resonates with them. So some people are mantra people, we'll teach them mantra right away. Some people are compassion people. I try to make sure everybody learns compassion meditation as soon as humanly possible, because it really begins to change people. Once they start doing compassion meditation, they begin to change. You see people change when they start doing shamatha. You see people change when they start doing the compassion meditation. And you see people change when they start doing mantra. It's going to be different for each person. But these three practices, shamatha, compassion meditation, and its associated disciplines, with the compassion meditation, there's like a daily meditation practice, off the cushion practice, where you watch and work with your mental afflictions every day. It's called lojong, or mind training. And we use our emotions and our reactiveness to actually train our minds to be more loving. It's like weird, but it works. And then the mantra practice helps people who have a devotional side to their being to connect to that devotional side and connect to their Buddha nature. Because all three of these practices, shamatha, compassion, and mantra, help people to connect to their core being, which we call Buddha nature, their basic mind. So I don't know, did that help?
It does, but so I was speaking more to the idea of I took refuge, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I understand that you could then take the precepts and then the bodhisattva precepts after that, or then after that, I don't know what the next step is, but I know empowerments are way after that, probably. I don't know.
I see what you're talking about. You're talking about the precepts and vows. Yes, we start with the vow of refuge, because that's where you actually begin to walk the Buddhist path. And then everything after that becomes part of your Buddhist path. I mean, everything becomes part of your path once you've taken refuge. And then some people choose to, they don't have to, they're not required, to take precepts like no killing, no stealing, no lying, and that kind of thing. They want to take what we would call the layperson's version of monastic discipline. Okay, we're like lay people, and we stay lay people. We can, still get married, have relationships, and all of that sort of thing, but we are trying to keep stronger discipline to watch our minds a little more, because we're watching our behavior. And some people choose to do that, some people don't. The bodhisattva vow is next after that, because that's where you say, from now until enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, just as the Buddhas of the past have trained in love and compassion and bodhicitta, so I too will train, right? And then everything that happens after that is impacted by your bodhisattva motivation. You become a bodhisattva in training, essentially.
Okay.
I don't know. Is that at the same level as the Padawan learner? I forget. Anyway. So anyhow, Star Wars. What can I say? But then empowerment may actually happen for a person. Vajrayana empowerment, where you are empowered to do a mantra of a specific Buddha or Bodhisattva. Sometimes that happens right when a person takes refuge. They'll take refuge and then immediately in that same session receive an empowerment. We don't do it that way here because we don't have, the lamas here are not empowerment giving lamas. We have to invite special teachers to come and do that for us. But then the empowerment helps us to connect to the Buddha that's within us through the symbolic means of mantra and visualization. And then after that, the practice that we eventually do is something called Mahamudra. Maha means great, and mudra means seal, like authenticity, the seal of authenticity on a document, for example. And that's where we learn to use our mind to understand how our mind is. We actually use the mind to meditate on the mind. I know that sounds like a weird thing, but it takes some practice. And we begin to see how mind is in all of its experiences, because the mind is actually the seat of all of our experience. Mind is where everything is happening right now. Everything that's happening for you this minute, this room, this place, this sound, this everything, this is all actually happening in our minds. We are experiencing all of this with our bodies, yes, but also with our minds, and that our minds are what determine whether our experience is a good one, not a good one, or what our experience is. And it's learning about that process and learning how to work with that process so that we actually have truth inside every experience that we have. We see the truth of everything, the truth of how things appear and the truth of how things really are. They call that the two truths. So I don't know if this is helpful, but we eventually do that practice. We have several people here who have approached that practice, done that practice, and so on.
So. Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. Yeah. Oh, we're doing pretty well here. I may end up giving a little Dharma talk on love and compassion at the end here. Yeah.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
I'm pretty intrigued by the process of living in the unknown, kind of without expectations, and just being kind of open to whatever goes on, and kind of the I don't know it all, kind of the humility that goes with that.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that process and
how
you can carry that on all day long?
I'll tell you what, you know, I there's an easy way to do it and a hard way to do it.
Well, okay. Let's work on the easy way.
Let's work on the easy way. Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, boy, I'm totally in appreciation of that. Believe it or not, I was talking to another Buddhist teacher named Ken MacLeod, who translated my favorite book, The Great Path of Awakening. And he said that Buddhist mind training, or Lojong, he said it's genius. He says it's mindfulness plus. He said it's mindfulness plus. He said, you know, like you could advertise it. It's mindfulness plus. It's mindfulness plus putting into your mind stream the wish to benefit beings. And he said, just that simple wish to benefit beings is how you become aware of your moment-to-moment thoughts. Because he said, you'll notice when you're not there, when you're not wishing for the benefit of beings, you'll notice when you begin to feel selfish, fixation take over in a relationship, in a conversation, even in how you look at yourself. You keep your, you know, you become more aware of your motivation moment to moment to moment, and you try to adjust your motivation to be the motivation to benefit others. And he said it's painless that way. He said you can become just as aware of your mind and its activity by doing this bodhicitta or bodhisattva practice. He says it's just as good as some of this deep penetrating insight, you know, into the nature of all phenomena, which is a lot more difficult. But he said it's easy when you are engendering the wish to be of benefit to everyone you encounter, because that way you can change everything you experience to no longer be about you, but to be about what's best for everyone. And Pema Chodron, I think maybe some of you are familiar with the books of Pema Chodron, the American Buddhist nun. She wrote a book called Start Where You Are, and Start Where You Are, and then another one is Go to the Places That Scare You, and things like that. She says that her teacher used a Tibetan term called Shenpa, and I'll spell that in English, S-H-E-N-P-A. P-A, Shenpa. And it literally means other, aware, you know. So it basically, it means to be hooked by something. You know, you're hooked by something. And she says, if you get good at this, she said, you're going to actually notice the instant when your selfishness and your selfish fixation kicks in any situation. Like, for example, you walk in to, you walk into a restaurant to meet a friend or something, right? And then in the corner, you see that person. That person you argued with last week. The person who called you a name and who you don't want to speak to or don't even want to see today. So there's going to be a moment where you're happy and buoyant because you're going into the restaurant to meet a friend and have food or whatever you're going to do, right? And then suddenly, this thing happens. That's what Shenpa feels like. It's that tension in your body, in your mind. You know, I call it the tension of complication. It's like your mind is kind of like open and easy and la-di-da, and then suddenly, it's like tense. And that is the feeling of Shenpa, of self-fixation, like I am mad at them and they owe me an apology and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But it all starts with that moment of Shenpa. So the teaching is, if you get good at this, at noticing Shenpa, and then working with it instantly when it arises, you don't need to worry too much about like deep meditative insight on the nature of all phenomena. You can actually just work with your mind to be more loving, kind, and open to itself and to others. And that's why Ken MacLeod called this mind training genius, because he says it's mindfulness plus this building of a virtuous mind and intention. I don't know. I kind of think it's cool.
So then when you go into this restaurant, see that person, what are you supposed to do? Go over and say hi, shake their hand or something?
Supposed to is going to vary for, you know, your mileage will vary. So, at the very least, you notice your motivation and you take responsibility for your motivation.
Right?
You take responsibility for your feeling and your reaction. And the technique is, I am feeling anger. You actually describe it to yourself. I am feeling anger right now about that person. You don't say, oh, it's them. And then you spin off into the story of how they wronged you or what the heck ever, you know? And so that's what you're not supposed to do, is spin off into the story, right? And so what you do instead is the moment you recognize you're feeling anger, you think, I have business cards with this printed on. I need to carry it with me always. Oh, sorry. May my anger contain the anger of all sentient beings. By my working through this moment of anger, may I and all beings be free of these kinds of feelings, and may we all become Buddhas, which is the complete freedom from this kind of this reaction. And so by anchoring ourselves in that motivation, in that moment, we may not choose to speak to them because we're still too angry. But we are going to notice and take responsibility for and work with our own anger. And that means that whether we speak to that person or not is going to depend on where we are inside. But you don't want to get into an engagement when you're still really angry. You want to take the time until you can be where that person is. Okay, does that help?
Very much.
Okay, very good. I'm glad we had this conversation. There's time for a couple more questions, and then I'll give a short bit on love and compassion. Yeah. I'm so glad you asked that question, Tim. That's excellent. Yeah.
Hey.
Hey, hi there.
So earlier we were talking about kind of the human need to control others, that kind of idea. My question is more about what happens when you're on the other side of that, when somebody else has a very rigid idea of what you should be, kind of how do you set a boundary without getting too attached to that I am statement yourself, and while also kind of coming at it with compassion and understanding for somebody else, but still kind of sticking up for yourself in a way.
Say that last part again, please.
How you kind of come at it with understanding and compassion for the other person.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I get this. This is my life, you know, trying to figure out the middle on something like this is not easy, right? Because when you're the person that somebody is trying to control, it's a little bit because you get resentful, right? And I think this is kind of where I was going in the next part, if I would have continued my answer to you, Tim. I think sometimes when people are coming at us with, you know, with something, like you should do this, or you should do this, or you're like this, or you're like that, I think our first reaction, of course, is always going to be defensive. Like, I'm not like that. You're the bad person. I'm not the bad person, blah, blah, blah. Okay, it's, you know, and that doesn't make anything better either. We have to find a way to buy ourselves some time so that we can do something really challenging. And that is, can we go to the place of the other person's fear? Because when people come at us with this stuff, it's because we scare them. Something about us scares them. Okay, all right. Anybody who's ever been bullied in their life knows what this is about. Okay, when I was in school, I got bullied, sixth grade to like 11th. And then they lost interest. This group of girls, they were on my back the whole time. So, but what my mother said was very interesting. She said, who you are scares them and they can't take it. Who you are, you know, sensitive, kind, it scares them and they can't take that, right? So they know that they can get the better of you if they hate, you know, if they come at you with anger and negativity and you know, snide remarks and things like that. And then my grandmother had an even basic, a better way of saying it. She said, oh, they're just digging a hole under you, and so they look taller. They're digging a hole under you so they look taller. I was like, what? I've never heard that before or since. Go, Grandma. Go, Grandma. Go, Grandma. And so going to the place of the other person's fear is being able to take a breath, right? And realize you're okay, but they're hurting. The person who's coming at you is hurting, right? And I know it's cliche, you know, to say who hurt you, but the idea is that somewhere in us, we have to realize that somebody hurt them to turn them into the person they became, who is now bullying us. I talked to a woman once who had some really incredibly negative things happen to her. And she was she was really hateful toward the person who hurt her. And I said, can you imagine that person as a four-year-old child? And she said, as a matter of fact, I just saw a picture of this person as a four-year-old child. And I said, well, you can't have compassion maybe for the person they became, but look at that little child and think about what happened. Something had to happen to that little child to turn them into the person who hurt you. And she started to cry because she realized that people are not necessarily born being mean or being controlling. And so if we can go to what scares people, like they're scared that I'm going to change and I won't love them anymore. Or they're scared that if I don't do everything they think I should do, that something bad will happen in the world. I've met people like that. You know, like if I don't do absolutely everything. And then you have to figure out how you can be a whole person while helping them. I don't know about you, but I got into this with my parents. I got into this with my parents. My mom wanted me to be a certain way. My dad wanted me to be a certain way. Dad was a little cooler. Mom was pretty tight. And so it took a very long time for me to both, for me to be able to say to my mom, look, you know, I'm not going to please you. I'm super sorry about this, but I have to live my life and I have to do what I have to do, but I still love you. And I think that for me with my mom was the way I was able to help myself by just giving her what I could give her of my time and attention, because she wanted more than I had. So I think everybody goes through this in different ways, but it's mainly about feeling the place of the other person's fear. And if you are in a dangerous situation, a person has to get out of that situation. You can't just say, oh, I'm training to be a compassionate bodhisattva, so like I have to deal with this. I have to put up with this abuse. You don't. You know, you don't. Because right now we are not compassionate like the enlightened bodhisattvas. We're not as compassionate as the enlightened. We're just not capable. We got a limit. And you know what my teacher said? He said, you have to know your limit because you're not an enlightened bodhisattva right now. So he says, your compassion has limits and you got to respect those limits. He said, if you begin to resent a person you are trying to help, you begin to resent them, you have gone too far, and you actually need to back up and say, I have helped you as much as I can. I can do no more. And that was very freeing for me to hear, and I hope it's freeing for other people to hear too, because sometimes that's it. I am not sure if that answered your question.
It did. That was actually very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks. I have time for one more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I answer a question and then when I'm done, I'm like, ooh, maybe I missed the point of that question. So I hope it was helpful. Yeah.
Hi, Lama Kathy.
Hey, good morning.
So this morning we had somebody come into the library with a question, and forgive me if this was one of you out there and you feel called out, but somebody asked for a book on the Eightfold Path geared at beginners. And Austin and I went looking through the library, and we couldn't find one. We couldn't find one in there. And we were really surprised by that, and we were wondering, where does the Eightfold Path fit into the Karmakagyu lineage? Is that something that we learn about?
Yes, it is, but not in the same way as they learn about it in other traditions. It's fascinating. Now, let's see if I can recall. I have to kind of dig in my brain here for something. Those of you who are in the Nangi Shedra class, that we meet once a month to review Kenpo Ken Holmes' encyclopedic Dharma books. You know, he wrote this incredible encyclopedia of Tibetan Buddhism. It's really amazing, and we get together and study it once a month. He explains in his exposition that the Eightfold Noble Path of right intentions and right thought and so forth and so on was actually formulated in the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism by at the request of a king who needed a step-by-step-by-step path. Because as we just saw earlier, Buddhism is quite big. And people need a doorway, and people need an organizing principle. And so the Eightfold Noble Path became that organizing principle in the Theravadan tradition. Mm-hmm. But you do see it less in the Mahayana traditions of Zen. You do see it less in Zen. You do see it less in the Tibetan tradition, because those are all based on the Mahayana presentations. What we do in Tibetan Buddhism is, if you remember the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, you know, suffering's part of life, suffering has a cause, suffering has a solution, and there's a path. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche explained the path with the Buddha's four statements. Mm-hmm. The four statements actually summarize the Eightfold Noble Path. Do no harm whatsoever. Practice virtue as much as possible and tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Well, that's great. The last one's just a summary, so now we only have three. Mm-hmm. Much easier to remember three than to remember eight. Do no harm, means to not harm yourself, not harm others. Practice virtue means to take care of yourself and benefit others. And tame your mind means to meditate. Okay, so believe it or not, these three statements summarize everything in the Eightfold Noble Path. Mm-hmm. And so we don't do the step-by-step practice saying, first, everyone has to practice right intention.
Right.
Then everyone has to practice, you know, right thought. Then everyone has to, you know, right speech, right livelihood, right memory, right meditation, and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. We don't have it like you do the first noble truth for 3 weeks, and then you do the second noble truth for 3 weeks. It's not like that. Where we put that is we put it in the mind training, Lojong.
Lojong.
It's in Lojong because if you have to, when we were talking about motivation, you know, with Tim's question, we have to watch our motivation, and that really awakens right intention and right thought and right speech. You know what I'm saying? Because if you know what your motivation is for anything that you do, right, and you're willing to take responsibility for your motivation being selfish or whatever, that's kind of that. So we do it differently. It's there.
Gotcha.
It's there, but it's not taught in the same way. In fact, in Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths, mm-hmm. near the end of the book, when he's talking about the qualities of a Buddha, he talks about the Eightfold Path from the point of view of completion, that a Buddha has perfect intention, perfect thought. You know, and so that these eight factors are part of the display of a fully awakened Buddha. So that's why you don't see it quite so much in the northern schools. The southern Theravadan schools emphasize it a lot because it came up as part of their training. But for us, it's embedded in mind training.
I see. So
there's another. So Kempo Rinpoche's book, Excellent at the Beginning, mm-hmm. is a really good introduction to mind training, where he talks about how to meditate on compassion on the seat and how to meditate on it when you're walking around. And then there are, and in terms of this taking responsibility, any of the Bodhisattva literature, any of the bits of Bodhisattva literature will teach you how to pay attention and how to overcome self-fixation, which is really what the Eightfold Noble Path is all about. The Eightfold Noble Path is meant to help us overcome selfishness.
Gotcha. Okay, so it sounds like Excellent at the Beginning and Dharma Paths would be good recommendations for that person.
It would be a good recommendation for that person.
Wonderful.
Because
if you're out there, come see me in the library.
And they're on the beginner shelf, right?
They are, yes.
So anybody can take them out.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Mama Kathy.
Oh, you know, you're welcome. Thank you. Well, this has really been great, and I'm sorry, you know, that we didn't have like a cohesive Dharma talk for you today. But sometimes I think that being able to just address what questions people have is a good thing. Did you have a question, Tim, or were you just stretching?
I was.
Oh yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. I'm with you. Well, you're going to like this. I decided to open my favorite book and read to you from it. I love it when this happens. There's a slogan in the mind training book called The Great Path of Awakening. Great Path of Awakening is based on a 19th century book based on a 12th century text. I said 12. Maybe. Could be 11th. Anyway, and where they try to help you by having you memorize 59 slogans. How could anybody memorize 59 slogans? It's just like too much, right? But some of them will. But if you read the book a lot, then the slogans will come back to you. Look at this one. Work with whatever you encounter immediately. Ooh. Okay, I'm just going to read what's here. This was written in the 19th century by a Tibetan monastic named Jamgon Kantrol. You know, the stuff he's talking about is your everyday concerns. When illness, demons, okay, interruptions or disturbing emotions come unexpectedly, or you see someone else troubled by some unpleasant situation, think, I shall just practice sending and receiving, meaning I will just practice compassion for them, sending them love and compassion. In all of your virtuous thoughts and actions, think like this. And he gives you a script. May all sentient beings come to engage naturally in much greater Dharma activity than this. Like sometimes when we do good stuff, we hope people notice. And it kind of like makes it, tarnishes what we're doing a bit. Like, hey, see how good I am? So what he's saying is, may all sentient beings come to engage naturally in much greater Dharma activity than this. Do the same when you are happy and comfortable. If some evil thought arises, or you are forced to engage in some form of evil activity, think like this. May every evil thought and action of every sentient being be gathered in this one. In summary, maintain the motivation to help others. Whatever you are doing, eating, sleeping, walking, sitting. As soon as you encounter a situation, good or bad, work at this practice of mind training. They heard your question. Isn't that interesting? No matter, you know, in summary, maintain the motivation to help others, whatever you are doing. So that's pretty darn cool, actually. So we'll stop here for today. Thank you for being so kind and so generous with your attention. And I enjoy talking to y'all. So thank you for just being part of this sort of collaborative thing. I grew up, as you know, as a writer, and my first career was in journalism, and I got to have a Twitter exchange with my hero, Susan Stamberg, a retired reporter from National Public Radio. So it was like, oh, Susan Stamberg got to speak to me on Twitter. I feel so special. I got to tell her that she was interviewed once where she said that the best interviews are those in which the interviewer and the interviewee enter into a mutual collaboration. It becomes collaborative. She said, I almost use the word conspiracy. She said, it's almost like we're conspiring together to create something new. And I thought about how generous of that person, how generous, you know, like you guys are this Dharma talk. So I just wanted to thank you for being part of that, collaboration. Let's dedicate our marriage. We'll recite it once in English and once in Tibetan. Gathering together all the goodness that we've created here, may all beings be free from suffering and come to Buddhahood. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. I'll recite it in Tibetan. Oso nam diye tam che se pa ni Tom ne ne pe tra nam pam je ne ke ga na chi pa lap tru pa hi si pe so le tro war tro war sho jam pa pa wo ji tar ken pa tang Kun tu sampo te yan te shin te De da kuen gi che su ta lo ching
Kewadi datam cheraptu. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Have a wonderful afternoon. Safe home, and thanks to the sound department once again. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.